A majority of New Yorkers agree that migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. want to build a better life for themselves and for their families, according to the latest poll from Siena College. But Don Levy, director of the college's research institute, says when you dig deeper into the poll numbers, attitudes about migrants are more split. For instance, about a third of those polled believe immigrants take jobs away from Americans or could potentially be dangerous.
And they're afraid. They're afraid for their jobs. They're afraid for their tax dollars. They're afraid about the potential impact on criminal behavior that they think is very real.
Nearly two-thirds of poll respondents said they support a pathway to citizenship and say it should be easier for migrants to be granted work authorizations, regardless of immigration status. You're listening to After All Things, WSHU's daily news update from the Connecticut, New York region. A judge rules the creation of New York's ethics panel is a violation of the state's constitution. The first turbine of Vineyard Wind should be finished up in a week or so, and those retroactively added to the sex offender list look to Connecticut lawmakers for help. Those stories and more are coming up. I'm Sabrina Garone. Governor Hochul says she'll try to appeal a court ruling that struck down New York's ethics panel, saying its structure was unconstitutional. Karen DeWitt has more.
Shortly after Hochul took office 2 years ago, she and the legislature created the state's Commission on Ethics and Lobbying in Government. At the time, they said it would restore the public's faith after multiple scandals that included the resignation of her predecessor, former Governor Andrew Cuomo. But State Supreme Court Justice Thomas Marcel ruled that the panel violates the state's constitution because it's too independent of the governor and her executive powers. The ruling also says the commission, whose members are chosen by a rotating panel of law school deans, creates essentially an unsanctioned fourth branch of government. Blair Horner is with the New York Public Interest Research Group. He says the panel joins a long list of failed attempts to police ethics in New York, a state that has seen four Senate leaders and an assembly speaker convicted of corruption charges in the past couple of decades. He agrees with the judge that the law school deans were not the right people to choose the commissioners.
The law school deans are not independent, really, because they represent entities that are regulated by the ethics agency. So that created, in our mind, a conflict that was a serious flaw.
Ironically, says Horner, the judge's ruling stems from a lawsuit brought by former Governor Cuomo. He sued the ethics panel after they tried to force him to return earnings from a $5 million memoir that he wrote in the first year of the COVID pandemic. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Workers are busy installing the first of 62 offshore wind turbines off the coast of New England for Vineyard Wind. Components arrived at a wind farm last week, but the first turbine won't be complete for some time. Jeanette Barnes has more.
Some smaller turbines in Europe can be installed in about a day, but the first one here will be relatively slow going. That's because workers are double-checking safety protocols for the new, larger model, and because the parts first have to be lifted up from a barge and placed on the installation vessel, says Klaus Muller, CEO of Vineyard Wind.
The biggest point here is that this is a huge turbine compared to others, right? And the lifts are pretty weather sensitive because of the magnitude of these components.
He says the first turbine should be finished within a week or two, depending in part on Hurricane Lee. At some point, he hopes to reach a rate of one turbine every 4 days. Vineyard Wind plans to start generating power later this year, with however many turbines are ready. He says possibly five. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Jeanette Barnes.
Top lawmakers in the Northeast are calling on Congress to provide more direct help to local growers impacted by July's flooding. Michaela Savitt reports.
Lawmakers are asking the federal government to approve more aid for New England farmers as part of a spending package needed to avert a government shutdown on October 1st. A letter from U.S. Senator Chris Murphy and over a dozen New England legislators asks the House and Senate Appropriations Committees for more money to aid affected farmers. Most of the workers run small to mid-sized farms, and aren't well protected by federal risk management programs, the letter says. Many producers lost all their crops this season, and a large number of them will see long-term damage due to the July flood. According to federal weather officials, the disaster is one of nearly $2 dozen billion climate disasters the U.S. has already sustained this year. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Michaela Savitt.
Connecticut lawmakers are split on whether to create more options for reprieve for residents on the sex offender registry. That's after headlines and a message from our supporter.
Support for After All Things comes from Hartford HealthCare. More COVID vaccine answers at hartfordhealthcare.org/vaccine or 833-621-0600.
Today is primary day in Connecticut. Only residents who are registered Republican or Democrat can vote in their party's primary election. Democrats in Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford have mayoral primary elections, and Republicans in Derby and West Haven are also choosing their candidates for mayor. For complete coverage of the races, go to WSHU.org. Friday marked 1 year since Suffolk County was hit by a ransomware attack that may have exposed personal data of 500,000 residents. The cyber attack knocked out or limited several services, including civil service testing, traffic and parking violations, police dispatch, and the county's main website. Most services have been restored at this point, but operations from the county comptroller's and clerk's offices still remain locked. A tenants' union reached a tentative deal with their landlords in New Haven following a week-long protest that ended on Friday. Members of the Blake Street Tenants' Union protested in response to getting no-fault eviction notices in August. The tenants believed their evictions were in response to the union's opposition toward a 20% rent increase. Apartment manager Ocean Management rescinded the notices and vowed not to make similar eviction actions for 3 months. Connecticut residents on the sex offender registry claim their right to due process was violated after registration requirements changed. Jaden Edison is the Connecticut Mirror's justice reporter. He spoke with WSHU's Ebong Udama about whether lawmakers will consider expanding options for reprieve.
You use the example of Aaron Kearney, a 52-year-old Bridgeport resident, to illustrate the conundrum faced by some who are on the Connecticut Sex Offender Registry. Could you tell us about his story?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, Aaron was someone who testified in front of the legislature earlier this year in March during testimony for a bill titled Senate Bill 1194, which would have ended the retroactive requirements for people added to the sex offense registry. But basically, Aaron, back in 1997, pleaded guilty to third-degree sexual assault. But at the time of his conviction, which he pleaded guilty, making that agreement with the state, the public sex offense registry, as we all know it, didn't exist. It wasn't until after the fact, when he had already served his time, that he found out months after that he was required by law to be added to this sex offense registry. And so I think what you're seeing is that Aaron and a number of people who were retroactively added to the registry are now at a place where they believe, you know, their rights to due process were violated, right? In terms of, you know, we made an agreement with the state and there was an additional sentence, as they describe it, you know, added to kind of what they had already agreed to and after they had already served time. And so that's kind of what you're seeing. And back to the retroactive provision, what you see is that in 1998, when Connecticut enacted the public sex offense registry for people convicted of what the state described as sexually violent offenses in the 10 years prior to the law as well, so dating back to 1988, also were required to register. And so that's kind of where this whole scenario, this whole story kind of stems from.
So now he's been on the registry for 25 years, and how does he get off the registry?
It's hard, right? I mean, Connecticut, very kind of limited exceptions. And so I think, you know, he's in a scenario right now where basically he's trying to seek legislative action to get off the registry, right? I think what people are hoping is that the legislature comes in and says, we understand, particularly with the people who are retroactively added, that this raises concerns and questions about due process. And so the ball's in the court of the legislators now to decide, you know, as they kind of pondered this past year, whether that's something that they're willing to do. And so that's kind of the avenue that I think Aaron and others are trying to exhaust at the moment, understanding that, I mean, Connecticut's registry, it's pretty clear cut, right? And, you know, to even, you're on the public registry, there are very few and limited exceptions for people who convicted of sex offenses. There are very few options for reprieve. And so
what happened to the bill that was introduced in the last session?
This was almost movie-like, watching this bill kind of proceed through the legislature, right? It you know, this is something that it stood out to me particularly, right? Because when you're at the committee level, the Judiciary Committee, which is a pretty, it's one of the biggest committees, you know, what, 37 legislators, if I'm not mistaken, they seem sympathetic to what's going on here, right? As folks are coming to testify, including Aaron and others. So it passes through the Judiciary Committee, you know, it passes through the Senate overwhelmingly, 34-3, which, you know, at least indicates that the vast majority of the committee is at least willing to continue to talk about this thing and figure out if there's something that they can do. It gets to the Senate, passes through the Senate 24-12, mostly along bipartisan lines with a few exceptions. And then it gets to the House, right, which, you know, has 151 people, you know, more diverse, you know, way more people. And people, quite frankly, you know, which is the case in politics in general, is that people are being introduced to these bills oftentimes for the first time when it reaches the floor. And so I think what you saw was that it's a bill pertaining to the sex offense registry. And I think that kind of scared, you know, a bunch of people, quite frankly, and that was reflected in the debate. And so I think as it kind of progressed, the debate got kind of heated. You know, there were people, particularly Representative Tammy Nuccio, who is the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee, who raised concerns about kind of the most egregious versions of sex offenses and kind of what it would mean to take roughly 800 or 900 people off the registry without some sort of formalized review process. And so, again, there was just a lot of kind of information out there, some of it which, right, wasn't necessarily rooted in kind of what the data and what the facts say. But nonetheless, you know, emotion kind of took over. And so, you know, they decided to pull the bill. And after that, it never made it back. And that was the end of it.
So what does the data say? What do researchers say about repeat offenses by people on this sex offender
registry? So I think you have now, you know, at the time when a lot of rulings were made early on in the early 2000s as it pertains to the sex offense registry, you know, there's a much different place than where we are now having 25 years of the existence of the public registry and data, recidivism data that kind of is associated with that. And I think what I've seen in my reporting and in talking with the experts is that data shows that over 25 years, right, the registry in and of itself has little to no effect on reoffending, recidivism, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you also see very low recidivism rates, again, as time progresses, right? So the longer that someone does not, you know, reoffend, the less of a risk that they are. And we've seen that in Connecticut, you know, in a study from the Office of Policy and Management. Well, I think this might have been published somewhere in the early 2010s, so it would have been around 2012 or so. They basically took a study and looked at a sample size of people who were released from prison, some roughly 700 or so people who were released in 2005. And within the 5-year period, only 20 of those people have been rearrested and convicted on a new sex-related kind of charge. And so what you're seeing, again, is just very low recidivism rates. The recidivism isn't, you know, it's less so in some cases, right, than people who are convicted on non-related sex crimes. And so, again, I think what you see, though, is a group of people who are particularly homogenized. And I think some of the experts alluded to that, homogenized and misunderstood, because of we're talking about this very kind of polarizing topic that people get very emotional and passionate about for various reasons.
And you mentioned that some researchers say that race might play a factor in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to me, this is a very fascinating part of it, right? Because I think, you know, when you think about the sex offense registry in our society, right, maybe perhaps you have an image again of what's been kind of talked about as a stereotypical person behind the bushes who's, you know, out to get your child. And what you find is that's not necessarily the case. It represents a very slim majority of people, and the people who are disproportionately affected by the registry are overwhelmingly people of color, particularly people like Aaron Kearney, right, who in Connecticut make up roughly a quarter of people who are on the registry, despite only making up 13% of the state's, roughly 13% of the state's population. And so just like you see in other areas of criminal justice, there is the kind of disproportionate effect that these policies have had over the last 25 years.
Well, thank you very much, Jaden. Jaden Edison is the Connecticut Mirror's justice reporter. His article is titled, Just Existing, Not Living, Connecticut Residents Retroactively Added to Sex Offense Registry Seek Reprieve. I'm Ebon Udama.
For the latest news from Long Island and Connecticut, you can listen on the radio or anytime online at WSHU.org or download the WSHU app. And again, that's also where you can find complete coverage of today's primary elections. After All Things is supported by Hartford HealthCare. I'm Sabrina Garone. Have a great rest of your evening. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you.